So there are two loose heads just floating around in here somewhere?
You can hear them at night. They whisper to each other and then cry.
Since our host isn't here, would anyone care to mix me a drink?
Horror films ask us many questions. Who will survive and what will be left of them? Who's going to believe a talking head? What's blood for if not for shedding? Do you like scary movies? Have you checked the children? Maybe we'll find the answers together. Thank you for joining us on Photo Flow, Terror in the Smiles. Here are your hosts, Eric Jones and Jake Almond.
Good evening. I'm your host.
Today is Star Wars Day, so we have decided, as we're recording this, watch a space movie that wasn't Star Wars. And this was actually my first time having seen it, but I've always wanted to see it because it was John Carpenter and Dan O'Bannon that I knew of that were involved in it. And I don't know who all else was involved in it, really, but I knew that Dan O'Bannon wrote it and John Carpenter directed it. And this is, to me, when I think of John Carpenter, I think of the earliest John Carpenter movie, for me personally, I mean, the one that I was maybe aware of first was probably like Halloween or something like that. But the earliest that I have in my collection before I bought Dark Star was 13, which to me feels like a first movie for him. So I was really interested in seeing Dark Star because it's more of a student film. And I was kind of surprised by it. Like, I thought it had a lot of potential. Like, I could see why. Like, I thought for a student film, it was pretty competent. I could see why it felt like it was Dan O'Bannon's first draft for Alien or something. You know, like, you could see a lot of the framework of Alien in there. I could hear maybe the earliest origins for Carpenter's, like, music score, you know, for some of the suspense scoring. It kind of felt like a very, very cheap version of, like, moments of like the Halloween score kind of peeking through occasionally, but for the most part it was really hard for me to latch on to anything in it in terms of like looking for something uniquely Carpenter. Whereas the Spielberg film that we were going to talk about felt very much like a thesis statement for Steven Spielberg. I don't know how you felt about them, but
yeah, so this was also my first time with Dark Star. That watching this now makes it the earliest Carpenter film that I've seen. The earliest I thought of, I would always think of course, would be Halloween. I've never seen Assault on Precinct 13, so I got to rectify.
Oh, well, that. We'll watch that for the show for sure. It's good. It's really good. But it feels like a John Carpenter origin movie, the way that Duel feels like a Steven Spielberg type of origin film for me personally.
That's what always intrigued me about it. It always seemed like, I know it would be more considered more of a action thriller crime type, but there was something just from the images I've seen of it, always looked very sort of grungy, almost like a prep for Escape from New York.
Exactly. It fits more in line with something like that and the total chaos of like a Big Trouble Little China type thing. But I mean, it feels very distinctly Carpenter. I mean, I'm not gonna say he didn't do horror movies, because he did like a lot of horror films, but I think that he typically gets known as a horror guy and he's the horror master, of course, but he has done some, like, you know, stuff that falls more into the action. He draws a lot from Westerns as much as he draws from any, you know, slasher tropes. So I think Assault on Precinct 13 still feels distinctly John Carpenter. Whereas Dark Star, it has some really cool moments in it. Like, I really, like, there was about a 45-minute movie in it that's what it originally was going to be. A $1,000 budget. 45 minutes, and then somebody invested more money into it and they expanded it to a feature length. I think they had a script for a 45 minute movie in here that was actually would have been a really tight, fun student film. And there are about 45 minutes of the movie that I genuinely enjoy. Like, there's just a lot of dead space in it too. No pun intended. There's just a lot of, okay, let's get through this so we can get to something kind of interesting. And then when it, like, the elevator scene, I thought was really fun and really cleverly shot, like, even a little bit suspenseful. And the whole, you know, when they're basically doing the classic science fiction trope of trying to get a computer, you know, trapped in, you know, trying to trap a computer with its own logic kind of a thing, yeah, at the end with the bomb. Like, the smart bomb stuff was funny to me. Like, that was genuinely compelling. I love stuff like that anyway. But, I mean, we've seen that in a lot of science fiction. And one of the coolest things about it is it draws from Philip K. Dick and Asimov and all these, like, science fiction writers the same way Star Trek does. So it has some of those same kind of elements in there. But it's just goofy. You know, it's goofy. They didn't have the budget to do the, you know, the suspense stuff. So, I mean, obviously they went for more of a comedic edge, but I think it undercuts what, you know, where really they should just cut the movie down and made it all about the bomb. That made it about an evil computer, because, or a confused computer, because that would have been, they did that part of the film better. And I thought the creepiness of the imagery, even of the guy that they had frozen that was still talking or whatever, like the dead body or whatever, like that was interesting. The whole ending was amazing. Like, I loved that part. Like, the total terror of whatever the frick happened at the end there with the guy joined up with, were they aliens or whatever, yeah, that he, like, merged with? It was like a V'ger type thing at the end there. And then the other guy surfs into the atmosphere of that planet. Like, I actually really loved the ending of it. But once again, make the whole thing this suspense, you know, thing about with the bomb, like a Twilight Zone episode, make it a little more suspenseful and keep it about the bomb and then end with that ending. It would have been fantastic. But yeah, no, it was cool. I'm glad I finally got to see it. And I was just hoping for more Carpenter. I feel like he was just like the guy that was around campus or wherever they were, you know, when he was hanging out. And I just don't, I mean, you can see that, like, there were some cool angles and stuff, but that was kind of my take on it.
Yeah, I felt kind of mostly the same. I was interested in as things began, even when you meet the beach ball alien that's like the ship pet or whatever. I was, you know, I was still hooked then, and like I said, I couldn't tell when was the point, but like I said, it was probably about the whole second act that I felt myself disconnected a bit, and then
that was me too. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And then once you get to the third, and like, it just seems like everything's falling apart. That was when it sort of, you know, sort of hooked me again. The funny thing that I thought was interesting is that I thought that the third act, it seemed like it borrowed from two Stanley Kubrick films. It felt like it borrowed from, obviously, 2001 with, you know, with a crazy computer. And then it felt like it borrowed from Dr. Strangelove with the whole idea of the bomb not working.
Zaniness of the ending with the ship exploding and everything just kind of being so, like to me, that's a horrifying, like, thought of, like, I'm gonna drift in space forever, or, you know, like, and then but they're just like, oh, okay, this is happening, you know, and the whole absurdity of that, of them just accepting their fate and just being like, oh, I'm going to merge with these aliens, and oh, I'm going to burn up in the atmosphere. What a cool way to die, kind of thing. Just the way they greet that, like you said, it is very Dr. Strangelove. It's very irreverent. And that part of it, I was actually tickled by that. Like, that was worth watching the movie for. It was funny.
Yeah. And I thought, and it was weird in a not like one of those, it like it not like it was you know, people like to say, sometimes like to say weird for the sake of being weird, which, I mean, truth be told, if it's weird, that's kind of why you put it in there, because it's, you know, because it's weird. I agree.
And science fiction lets us be kind of weird. That's kind of the fun of it.
Yeah, and I agree. It probably might have been best as a student film, or if it was like with, so since it's Star Wars Day, I'll you know, George Lucas, he, you know, his first film was THX 1138, but the feature length film was a expansion upon his short film, which was Electronic Labyrinth, THX 1138. I kind of wonder if Carpenter was able to make this as his student film the original way, and then, you know, if he was given a bit more of a budget and all that in time, and he would have expanded upon it, it might as a whole maybe felt a little maybe a little bit more cohesive. But it was quite interesting. And actually, what was one thing kind of surprising, I just from the video presentation of it, I thought this might have been like sort of you know, remastered, cleaned up or something like that. And it kind of really wasn't, but I kind of appreciated that, because I was like, you know what? That does put me in the mind to give me a little bit more, you know, a little bit more leniency to it as a, you know, as a student film, essentially.
Right. I'm not trying to judge it. Like, oh, yeah. Actually, considering the fact that it cost us $6,000, and considering the fact that it really is a miracle that it even is available, that we were able to, you know, that I was able to purchase it on Vudu nonetheless, and you and I were both able to watch it, the fact even available is amazing to me. So and it probably wouldn't be if it had any other legacy attached to it, it probably wouldn't be, but it is watchable. It's when I say, I just, for me personally, would I ever go back and watch it again? I don't know, maybe if I was just like, I don't know. I don't see myself at the moment going back and watching it again. But I didn't hate the fact. I wasn't bored. I found it amusing. I think part of what the thing that they didn't do as well as, of course, Dan O'Bannon and later on Ridley Scott and the other people that contributed to Alien, the thing that they didn't have was just an interesting enough group of characters, because it feels a lot like they're just kind of ad-libbing, yeah, and not really going off of any real script. And I know that they did have a script for Alien, but Alien also feels at times like it's very natural and almost ad-libbed, but it works in Alien. Like, the actors can do it, and whatever they captured, it feels very authentic, and feels like a blue collar crew. And this crew in Dark Star felt like a blue collar crew too. Like, they didn't feel like your typical space film characters. You know, they were just doing a job. Like, their job was to kill dead planets or whatever, yeah, dead stars or whatever, and basically just remove them from the galaxy or whatever with these smart bombs. And that was kind of interesting. Like, I thought, okay, I can see where Dan O'Bannon was basically still doing. His idea was blue collar workers in space, whereas like Alien was more like truck drivers in space or like miners or whatever. And I mean, I think you can see that. And it was funny, because I didn't know until I was reading the trivia, but I noticed that there was that scene where they were playing like Five Finger Filet or whatever with the knife, and I was wondering if that was what Aliens was doing. Like, Cameron apparently paid tribute to it.
I wouldn't Aliens. Be surprised.
I mean, that's what it said. Now, how true that is, I don't know, but it says on the trivia page that when Hudson and Bishop play that in Aliens, that it's a tribute to Darkstar. So, I don't know. Kind of strange. I mean, kind of funny that it is. I mean, apparently, this is why Alien exists. Like, one of the things that the movie taught me that I just always assumed Alien existed because of Star Wars. Like, I thought there was that big push, and it probably does to a degree. Like, the budget that Alien eventually got probably did come because of the popularization of science fiction, just like Star Trek, the movie, you know, Star Trek, the motion picture and all that got greenlit because of Star Wars. Alien probably did get greenlit because of Star Wars as well, but it's interesting that here we are, you know, a few years before Star Wars, and these guys are thinking this way. So the concept of the story and the talent thinking this is the kind of movie they want to make was obviously there before Star Wars. Star Wars just kind of helped open the door and make it possible for them to achieve it, you know? So it did kind of make me think a little bit differently. I'm like, okay. They actually wrote these ideas that O'Bannon had were there because he basically rewrote this script into, I think it was called Star Beast, and it was more of a horror script because they didn't have the budget to do more than the beach ball in this one. So in Star Beast, it was more like, he was like, I think the concept of Dark Star could work as a genuine horror film. And so that's what became Star Beast, which eventually became Alien. So I just thought that was interesting because I didn't know. It was kind of like a chicken and the egg thing. I was like, okay, did the idea for Alien come after Star Wars? And they were just like, let's do a space film, but let's make it scary. But apparently it was gestating before that. So I think Star Wars more or less just opened the viability of getting a movie like that greenlit with a bigger budget and getting a director like Ridley Scott, who had only really ever done like one art film before. You know, you get somebody who's visually really talented and has, and give him a budget. You know, I'm not saying Carpenter's not, but Carpenter, even in the stuff that he does super well, he's more minimalist than Ridley Scott is, if that makes sense. So I think Carpenter's better at capturing, he does science fiction well later on, but like even in his science fiction stuff, he's not really that worried about necessarily being super artistic. His movies look great, but he's more, it's hard to put it into words. Like he's much more of a minimalist. He's not pretentious with his style. He's not like over stylizing anything. So, you know, this movie just, it's a curiosity, but it's not unwatchable. I've seen much, much worse.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And like you said, I mean, probably not for a good while before I maybe consider watching it again. Maybe if one day I'm just like, hey, I'm really in a Carpenter mood and I really want to, you know, try to examine, you know, Carpenter a little bit deeper or whatnot. You know, maybe I might, you know, give it a shot. I agree. Just from the production value, is definitely more in line with his. They said far more, and it's interesting because, like, I, you know, when I always think of Carpenter, you know, yeah, I always try to think like, what is Carpenter's like visual style? And yeah, I can never really. I guess that would explain why I never really could describe it. And it's not that that really isn't there, because, you know, whatever, you know, like you said, he may be minimalist, but it's still a style. It's still
something. He's got a style, but I think it's more in terms of the way he puts his films together as an experience more than
something you see.
He's not necessarily being flashy. I mean, Halloween isn't really a flashy film, but the way he basically knows what the movie's meant to achieve, what kind of mood it's meant to achieve, whether it's Halloween, whether it's the moodiness and kind of, I mean, it wasn't really a term and it never really was, but I've always hear the term technoir kind of applied to Terminator. I think Carpenter did it first with Escape from New York. I think the atmosphere and the mood of Escape from New York with the synth soundtrack and the darkness in the film and how it kind of balances the campy with the genuine like grittiness for the time that it came out. I think it was a pretty gritty movie, but it's also a campy film in the right way. Like, it's the celebration of B movies meets like genuine talent, you know, and not that there wasn't a lot of talent with B movies. I'm just saying that it doesn't feel like it feels like a celebrate. Like, he loves those type of movies, so he's gonna do his own spin on it, you know. And I mean, that to me is what he does best. And so it was like Halloween, he's like, I know I want to make it tense and atmospheric, and he had Deborah Hill there writing, you know, realistic, you know, teenage girls, and then he puts them in the scary situation, and then he uses the shadows really well and stuff like that. I mean, that's Carpenter. He knows this is the mood I want to create with the music and the shadows and the sets. And he does that really well, but he's not doing, I've watched a lot of I have a whole shelf of Carpenter movies, but I don't necessarily think of any signature Carpenter shots necessarily, but I'm sure there are some for people that are much more, you know, in tune with that than I am. I feel like comparing the styles, like I never really think of Spielberg as being super, like one of the best filmmakers of all time. I'm just saying I never really think of him necessarily as being overly flashy either. But when you look at something like Duel, and like everybody always says Jaws is the movie that kind of proved Spielberg, I think if you look at Duel, you could say, oh no, I don't know, there's something going on there. The way that movie shot is pretty incredible, and it was 1971, and we'll get into it in a minute. But I mean, like, when I look at Dark Star, I'm like, I would be like, okay, I don't know what this Carpenter guy's gonna do. But then when I watch Assault on Precinct 13, it's the way the movie's put together and the pacing and the chaos and just the mood of the freaking rock and roll mood of his style. That's John Carpenter to me.
Yep, that's great. Yep, exactly. And I was reading. Oh, one thing I was just reading is Nick Castle was the alien. Dark Star.
That's funny. Okay. Well, I knew they were friends, so that makes sense. So they knew each other before Halloween and everything. But so that's wild. So he's been movie monster more than one time.
Yeah. So he started it off, and then we have a connection to from Dark Star to the Metal Gear series. You haven't played Metal Gear Solid 5 yet.
No.
Oh, okay. So in I can't remember if it was in Ground Zeroes, but definitely in the Phantom Pain, you have the iDroid, and Hideo Kojima said that the iDroid's voice, whenever you get to play it, was inspired by the computer voice in Dark Star.
Okay, that's funny.
Which I'm not.
Yeah, which was a woman who apparently was just answering the phones for the producer or whatever. She was like a secretary, and John Carpenter liked her voice so much that he was like, hey, you should be the computer voice. So he was, I couldn't tell. I kind of felt like they might have been parodying Star Trek with that computer voice, but I could be wrong. It felt like a parody. Like, it felt like they were making fun of all the female computer voices in the movies and shows and stuff. But,
and I've been watching a ton of Star Trek recently. It's so funny. I can't remember. I don't know if I was dreaming it or whatnot, but I was watching something and, oh, you know what? I think it might have been Star Trek, might have been the original series, but the computer kept saying, Dear.
Yeah. That was, I watched that episode not that long ago. I don't remember which episode it was, but yeah, they tried to program the computer to be more feminine and
because they were at a planet of women or something.
Yeah. And wanted it to be like sexier and like very, very 1960s idea of what making something more feminine would be. But it was like talking to Kirk in a very sensual way. And I felt like this computer in Dark Star sounded a lot like that as well. Like they were trying to make it sexy or something. I don't know. But like a joke, like as a joke. Because I really,
yeah, and that's the thing that I kind of wish maybe that I probably would have to give it another try. I'm just very curious as to what you said. Oh, it felt like O'Bannon's script might have been like the first draft, and that's what I kind of want to wonder. I don't know if it's available on disc or anything, or with a commentary or anything. I just kind of want to know what was it aiming for, you know, what was it aiming for? What was it trying to say? If it was trying to say anything.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think in parts, like there were parts of it that they seemed like they were really having fun. One of the things I haven't mentioned or we haven't mentioned yet was that I thought was interesting was how, and it's a trope you see on a lot of stuff now, was the it almost felt like a workplace comedy when they were leaning into the funny stuff.
Yeah.
And if they had leaned into that more, it could have been really great. Like there was potential here to make a really genuinely funny movie. Because I noticed one of the things they did that I think I've seen it in so many things now, but they really popularized it. I know it probably existed before, but they popularized it in The Office was like the moments where they would just have one character talking to the camera, like as an interview, like they were doing a documentary. And they did that sort of with the ship logs. And I thought, well, that's interesting because I had never seen, this might be the earliest example of that I've seen where they had, you know, they did it with The Office and they do it with the, I don't know if you've ever watched the vampire show, What We Do, What We Do in the Shadows.
Yeah.
They do it on there, and it's like, it's basically like, you know, you're doing a documentary or like a reality show, and then, you know, how it always cuts in any of those reality shows where they, like the Survivor or any of that, where they'll talk to the person privately so they could just really say what is on their mind. Well, they do that. They did that with Dark Star, and I thought that's kind of interesting. I've never seen that particular trope in something that old before. So, yeah, and that those moments were kind of funny. Like there was the moment where the guy was like, anytime they would curse, they would delete that part of the audio. Like they intentionally were keeping the movie pretty clean. Like I felt like they might have been a little. I don't know how much of that was because it was a student film, but it felt like they were kind of pulling back a lot at times. And I'm not saying the movie needed to be vulgar, but it had no teeth at all. Like,
yeah,
I wish that they had just leaned into the comedy of it more, but I feel like there was a part of them that wanted to make a genuinely scary film. The money wasn't there. So then they were ad-libbing, and then some of the actors made it funnier. And some of the stuff was kind of funny. Like, the ending is genuinely funny to me. Like I actually laughed out loud when all of that stuff was going on. But like you said, that was the Dr. Strangelove of it all, that kind of stuff I find very funny anyway when it's done well. But there was so much, like, the tone of the movie was kind of all over the place, and that might be worse. Like I could deal with the audio and the video presentation being kind of rough, but the tone made it kind of where I was like, okay, what are you trying to do here? Like, which is very un-Garpenter, like, because I feel like Carpenter's worst film, you know what Tony's trying to set. And even his worst film is a film that I genuinely enjoy. Like I think of a bad John Carpenter movie, and I don't actually consider it bad, I actually enjoy it, but I think of something like Escape from LA. It's genuinely not considered, like, it's not nearly as well loved as like Escape from New York, but it's kind of fun, and it sets out with a goal in mind, and to me it accomplishes the tone that it sets, which is much more of a parody of Escape from New York. Like he's just having fun with this movie, but it still actually kicks ass when it needs to. Like he is also one of my favorite moments of Snake Plissken is the way that the whole film ends with him just kind of blacking everything out, you know, resetting everything. It's, you know, and I like as actually more of a social commentary going on in Escape from LA that holds up maybe even better than whatever social commentary you could glean from New York. But it's not as, it's obviously, it's not for everybody, but the tone of that movie is more consistent than the tone of something like Dark Star. And a lot of that just comes from experience. You can't expect these guys to come out of the gate. Like the fact that they made a watchable movie out of the gate for $6,000 is incredible. Like they achieved something. You knew that there was talent there. It obviously got the attention of people that it needed to get the attention of, because they went on to make really great stuff. So yeah, it did what it needed to do. For that, I'll give them props for sure.
Yeah, it's a bit, yeah, LA is actually a good example, because yeah, I know, I mean, I've always enjoyed it. I know, yeah, it's definitely hit or miss with people when they're putting it as far as Carpenter's filmography. But the thing about it is, everything in it is intentional. Whether you got on board with it or not, you know, that's the thing. But it is intentional, and like you said, it, you know, it is a first. You know, this is a first film. I mean.
And how much of it was studio interference?
Yeah.
When I say studio interference, quote unquote, I know he got did not get along with the producer on Dark Star. Like, there's apparently a joke on the screen, but I didn't catch it. But reading through the IMDb, where he basically, the only vulgarity in the whole film apparently is a quick flash of "fuck you, Brandon" or something. I can't remember what the producer's name. It was something like that. Hold on. I think I actually had it on the screen a second ago. It says "fuck you, Harris." That's what it says. "Fuck you, Harris." And I didn't catch that, but apparently that was directed at the producer. So I don't know how much Carpenter maybe lost control of the project as soon as these other people invested money, because that can happen sometimes. And I can tell you this, as a Carpenter fan, if you really read up on him, the part of the reason why Carpenter doesn't make movies anymore is because every time he had success with something, like one of his movies hit really big, he would turn around and do something real. And a lot of times it was awesome and it would fail commercially. And then the studio wanted to take a chunk out of whatever he was doing. So in other words, he would end up catching success, get the deal to do a movie he really wanted to do. And then the studio, and then, it, you know, well, a good perfect example is The Thing.
Yeah.
You know, he was on the top of everything. And here he went on a hell of a streak even after The Thing, in my opinion. But when he does something like The Thing, it should have been his big hit. It should have been the one that really blew the doors off. And it's the people love more than anything from him. But at the time, it was a commercial failure. And after that, he just had to deal with nonstop bullshit from the studios. So he started doing smaller pictures that he could retain more control in, because he is an auteur. He's not a hired gun. He's going to do it Carpenter. You're never going to catch John Carpenter coming out of retirement to do, you know, a Marvel movie. You know, I'm not nothing against, like, but like a great example is we got Sam Raimi doing the new Doctor Strange, right? But Sam Raimi actually had a similar career trajectory as Carpenter, but Raimi can operate within those confines and still do something he wants to do, if that makes sense. Whereas I don't think Carpenter can. I think Carpenter's too much of a punk, you know, like I'm saying that in an endearing way. Like he's much more, he wants to shake things up. He's not just going to do a by the numbers studio film and be happy doing it. So I think when he did something like Ghost of Mars, you know, that was this, probably the last thing he ever did that was like kind of for the studio, which is essentially just the science fiction remake of Assault on Precinct 13 before it even had an actual remake, which it later did. And I think his experience was so negative doing this bigger budget science fiction film. I don't remember commercially how well that movie did, but that's neither here nor there. I just think his experience on it was so crappy. He might have done, like, he did The Ward, and I don't know if what you Masters of Horror thing, which was pretty, you know, pretty well received. But it's like, it's kind of lost. I mean, he's just the type of person, he had the money that he needed. He still enjoyed music. So he just kind of like, have fun doing this anymore. I'm not going to do it anymore. I've made the movies I want to make. I made some good movies. I'm just going to enjoy my life. So, he started playing video games and watching the Lakers and making music. And so now he's doing film scores. He's actually doing the score for the new Firestarter. And of course, he's done the scores for the newest Halloween trilogy and all that. So, and he goes on tour and he plays his music and stuff. So that seems to be what he's having fun doing. But he's just not the personality that he's like, you know, he'd rather not do it at all if he's just having to work for somebody else. It's just a job at that point. I think that's just kind of the way it went for him. But like Sam Raimi, he did movies like the Chevy Chase Invisible Man movie, which feels very much like a mid-budget 80s movie, right? And I think that seems to me to be like something that movie felt like it was kind of popular when it came out, but I think the most mainstream thing I could think of that he did was Starman. That was his comeback movie after The Thing, was Starman, and it did really well. And I think, you know, he managed to make something unique. I like Starman, but
he did do Christine in after The Thing. Immediate was, I don't know if Christine was successful, but that was,
I think, I think Christine did pretty well. Yeah. But I feel like Starman was the one that really went mainstream for him. Like the way I would have thought The Thing would go mainstream for him, I feel like I feel like Christine did too, because everybody really loved Stephen King stories back then. And I feel like Christine was pretty big, but I think Starman was even bigger because you could take your kids to see Starman. I mean, awkward sex scene and all, you could take your kids. It was more family friendly than Christine. Yeah. So
that's why I love when I think it was someone had tweeted him about, they're like, hey, how do you feel knowing that after all these years you've been vindicated after, you know, The Thing is considered one of the great horror films? And I love that his response was, well, I appreciate it, but I really would have appreciated it more then. I like that just because it kind of shows that, yeah, that's still, you know, that still stings, that he did this thing that he knew was good, and it tanked so bad that people were basically calling him a hack over it.
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, it's interesting. Yeah, that's ridiculous. Like, I just can't imagine. I felt like with The Thing, it was more or less people just did not go to see it. Like, I don't recall people. Everybody was in, but wasn't it the story of it came out the same time as E.T. or something?
And E.T. had been out, but it came out the same day as Blade Runner. And everybody was just at E.T.
Yeah. And it was like, okay, the friendly alien movie was what hit the zeitgeist at the time. And
it would just be like, if you're, you know, Doctor Strange comes out this week, it'd be like if you're going to release anything on the same day.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I don't know how much, like, E.T. was the Spielberg factor. I don't really know. I mean, he had done Jaws and he had done the Close Encounters, and there's a couple years, there's some years between those two, and there's some years between that and E.T. So I don't really know how much, like, I think E.T. was just the movie, like I said, you could take your kids to see.
He did do Raiders of the Lost Ark had come out
at that
one. So people were definitely probably high on Spielberg at that point.
Yeah. I mean, I do remember Spielberg was the name, right? Like, yeah. As a kid, I mean, how many directors did you know by name as a little kid? I think most of us knew who Steven Spielberg was, and that was even before probably the big movie for you and me would have been Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
So, like, as like, oh, this is a big freaking deal. You know, Jurassic Park was a huge deal. Like, I remember two films specifically from my childhood that felt like huge leaps forward, and that was Terminator 2 and Jurassic Park. And it was mainly just because of the budget size and the spectacle and the effects. You know, it just felt like these huge leaps forward, probably in the same way that maybe Star Wars might have felt if you saw it in 77. And Spielberg knows how to do this unique thing and still make it where your people can bring the family, and that does make more money. And Carpenter really doesn't make movies like that. So, like I said, Starman was like the only time I feel like he kind of dabbled in that, and it did pretty well for him. But, I mean, like, if I was gunned to my head, and I genuinely love Steven Spielberg, genuinely love him, love his movies, love, I'm glad they exist, right? Like, they mean a lot to me. But if you put a gun to my head and said, what are you taking to the desert island? I'm probably taking my Carpenter movies.
Yeah.
Like, if I was wanting to make, you know, if which movies would have made me want to make movies? I mean, Jaws aside, because Jaws is one of my all-time favorites, but I would say, like, Carpenter movies make me, like, I wish there were still, like, people making movies like that, you know, because he could take, I think he works better with lower budgets, like something like They Live, Halloween, Escape from New York, Big Trouble, Little China, none of those had, like, outrageous budgets, and they're all just so creative. That's what Carpenter brings to the table for me, is creativity. Like, Spielberg operates better when he's got money. I've never really seen a Spielberg film where it was like, oh my God, I can't believe he pulled that off with that tiny budget. You know, like, I don't really think of Spielberg, even Jaws, like, I don't really think of Jaws as it wasn't really a tiny budget, you know, like, the fact is they were able to go over budget. Like, Carpenter didn't have that option. So I'm not taking anything away from how much of a genius Spielberg is in terms of filmmaking, but Carpenter actually seems to do better under pressure. So, just in my opinion, like, I don't think he does well when you give, like, I think if you gave him a Spielberg budget, it's just not going to work as well. Like, I think he does better when he's having to be innovative. I think Carpenter, because I don't mean this in a bad way, but I feel like he, you give him too much money, he's gonna get kind of lazy about it. Like I think that he's like gonna relax a little bit more if you give him too much money on a movie. So, and that's just my perception. I have no reality to base that off of, but I just think that he came from a different time that doesn't exist anymore. That's part of why I think one of the things I respect him for is he kind of recognized that, like, hey, they don't want movies like I make anymore. Even though we do, there are those of us out there that do. He's like, hey, I made a good living, made some good friends. And I just don't think that they make, like, the general public wants those low to mid-tier budget movies anymore. So, I mean, indie films aside, you know, like, maybe if he was wanting to do stuff just for Shudder or, you know, a Netflix movie or something, I have no doubt they throw a check at him. But it also is really hard work even to do any level of movie. So, but I mean, you know, that aside, Dark Star's fun. I'm glad I watched it. I mean, it is what it is. It is cool, like, if you like that sort of thing. But watch it just for the ending. That would be my recommendation.
Yeah, I would. I would agree with all that. It's a, you know, I always have no problem watching someone's first film because I love being able to see where they started and what thing, you know, as you've watched movies from later in their career, trying to see what did they take from the beginning that's you know, there towards the end. It's fascinating, and like I said, it is fascinating to watch. It's, you know, under 90 minutes, so it's not going to take up too much of your time.
It was kind of cool to get to watch. I watched both of these. Like, I had started Dark Star a couple weeks ago, and then other stuff kept happening, and so we had to take a break doing the show. But it was interesting watching both of these movies that I was able to sit down and watch them both, you know, on the same day and still have like an hour before we recorded to kind of think about them, you know. Like, you know, it's harder to do when you're watching something that's, you know, breaks the 2 hour mark or whatever. So
yep, it was an interesting piece, and you know, I said I'm definitely glad that you picked this one.
Because yeah, not, I mean, it was a blind spot. It was a blind spot for both of us. So, I mean, I'm somebody who collects Carpenter. Like, my favorite, one of my all-time favorite Carpenter movies is Someone's Watching Me, which is one he did for television. And he shot it, I want to say he shot it before Halloween, because he kind of figured some things out. If you want to see kind of the prototype of Halloween, you watch Someone's Watching Me. But it feels more like his take on, like, a Rear Window kind of thing. But it has that suspense that you really can see in Halloween. And so he's kind of playing around with where to put the camera and how to, you know, how to edit in such a way that it builds suspense. So, and you kind of see other little Carpenterisms coming into it. Like, Adrienne Barbeau pops up, and she's a really great, like, the writing in it's really solid. Like, for a television movie, it feels really, like, it holds up well. Like, it's aged, that movie's aged really well. And I feel like watching that and Assault on Precinct 13, that's the origin of Carpenter for me. This feels like a demo tape. Like, if it was a band, this is the demo, and those two are the debut album. You know, like that's kind of how it works for me. Like, and some people, like, I don't know, like, Spielberg's, and, like, we can go ahead and get into the second feature, which came out in 1974, and it's called Duel. And Duel, talking about TV movies, Duel in the United States, if I'm not mistaken, was a television film.
Yep, that is correct. Yeah, it was on the ABC Family, the ABC Movie of the Week, November 13th, 1971.
Dude, this has to be one of the tightest, coolest ass, like, imagine just sitting down and watching let's watch the movie of the week, kids, and holy crap, dude. Like, what was my first experience watching Duel? On DVD, and in the behind the scenes, one of the behind the scenes specials, Spielberg was just talking about where he was when he made Jaws, and he said he had just came off of making this movie called Duel, and it was literally the first time I had ever heard the title when he said it in the interview. And he talked about how That movie taught him a lot, and when he was making Jaws, that was the only experience that he was really drawing from, was his experience making Duel, and he felt like that the suspense of Duel would translate to the shark. Like, the truck is the shark, and even at the end of the movie, he talked about how at the end of Jaws, when the shark blows up and it's floating down to the bottom of the ocean, that the shot is intentionally reference to Duel, when the truck goes over the cliff at the end and the dirt and so, I mean, if you watch it, it's like, holy shit, like, it really is, it's exactly the same ending, just, you know, with a truck instead of a shark, and even the sound effect of the dinosaur, like, he used from an old dinosaur movie from like the 20s or 30s, and probably, well, it would have been the 30s or 40s, he used an old sound effect from a dinosaur film for the truck when it was like, you know, like the supposed to be like the metal twisting or whatever. He uses that same sound effect for the shark as it's sinking. And I thought, I gotta see this. So we had Stars, which had like the Encore channel. We would play like older films back then, and Duel was coming on, and it just happened to be like around the time I had seen this interview. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna like record this on an actual VHS tape. And and I watched it like two or three times, like, I mean, around that same period of time, and I really dug it. Like, I thought, this is actually, how is this movie not more famous? Like, it's really good. And I know the only other Spielberg movie from this era,
Sugarland Express,
and I can't actually remember which one of those came first, but I want to say Sugarland Express actually came before Duel, but I could be wrong.
No, Duel was first.
Okay.
Sugarland Express was in 74.
But I feel like, well, so they were around the same time, but yeah, yes. I feel like Sugarland Express was more famous, and I don't know why. I mean, it's not a bad movie or anything. It's just Duel is like really freaking good, dude. Like, it's a genuinely good scary movie, and I don't know why it's not more celebrated. It still doesn't feel like it's beautifully shot, but watching it again today was actually kind of a revelation, because it had been, it's easily been near 20 years since I've watched it, and watching it again today, I was just as on the edge of my seat. Like, for whatever reason, this movie, I don't know how it affects you. You tell me your experience with it, but it affects me. Like, I'm 100%, I buy into every single moment of this movie. What was your first experience with it?
I first saw it in when I was in high school. I worked for the Free Library of Philadelphia. I worked there after school, like helping kids with homework and computer stuff like that. And so when I get a few moments of downtime, like usually when kids' parents are picking them up, that's when I'll go browse to see what's what. And so I'm browsing the movies, and I see Duel there, the VHS, you know, on the shelf, and they're like, this is Steven Spielberg's first film. And I was like, oh, I never heard of this. The earliest Spielberg I had heard of at that point was Jaws. Jaws and Close Encounters were the earliest of his that I knew.
Which is still early. Yeah. I mean, that's still like only a few years later. Like, Jaws is only 1 year later. So I mean, that's still very early Spielberg.
So I borrowed it, got home, watched it, and like you, I was like, oh my god, I was like, yo, this is ridiculously good. And then so I remember when I went back to work the next day after school, I looked to see if we had any books on Spielberg. So I just went flipped through the book or whatever, found reading about Duel, found out it was a television movie, and I was like, a TV movie? And because, you know, at that point, when I was in high school, between 99 and 2003, so at that point, that was,
TV movies were cheap for us.
Yeah, and that was when we'd get them two-parters on any of the broadcast channels, and I was just like, this was a TV movie? Because this was something bigger. And I had seen Jaws before by then, but I didn't, like, I didn't like fully like respect Jaws. Not that I disrespected it. It's just that I didn't realize at that point, like really what Jaws was. And then when I watched it, like you said, once I got Jaws on DVD myself and I watched it, and then I borrowed Duel again, I watched them both back to back. And I
remember that would be a good, that would be a good double feature for sure.
And I just remember thinking, I was just like, this movie is that good. Like, I was like, Jaws deserves
hot take, the praise, dude.
Jaws deserves the praise. Hot take for me,
but like, it's scarier than Jaws.
I would agree, because you know, if you're not like, for example, me, I'm not real. Like, I appreciate everything about Jaws. I'm not really a beach person, so it doesn't really get, and even when I do go to the beach, I don't really get in the water like that. Yeah. So it doesn't really get to me like that. Duel is like horrifying, because that's something that could be, you know, could be real to almost anybody in the world. Like, you're driving today, and
I've had people lose their mind on me in traffic, man. Like, I've actually had people try to run me out of off the road before. So
yeah, like, you know, and all you did was just give a honk on the horn because the light turned green, and somebody's flipping out on you. I had a guy, I remember years ago, I had a guy flip out on me because it was an arrow at the light. And I slightly hesitated. I thought I wasn't going to make the turn before the oncoming car went. So I just let it go. And then the light turned red. Guy is flipping out behind me, you know, and all that. And I'm just like, yo, this is like, this, it's nothing. All I did was just sit at a light, and this guy's flipping out. And Duel is something.
Scary, man.
Duel is something that could very well happen. And when I watch it, I'm like, every time I watch it, I say, this movie deserves it. It's not a case where it's like, well, Duel is like a rough draft for Jaws. No, Duel needs to be in the conversation on the same level as Jaws. And I don't mean that just as like hyperbolic. I literally mean it because they're both that good. They're both great pieces of suspense filmmaking. And for Spielberg to have gotten that so early in his career, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's a good script too, because it's like, I don't know how it was, like, I can't say like how they wrote it, but there's not like a lot of dialogue, and I never lose interest in it. Like, visually, like, I love the way he mounts the cameras on the car, and like, all like, you would like, a lot of this movie is just shots of the car going down the road, and I'm never bored. Like, I love all the angles are just so sad. There's something so satisfying about it. Like, it opens up with a bumper POV pulling out of the garage, and you're pretty much like, there are a few like little moments where you know, he ends up pulling off the road or running off the road or whatever, where he'll stop. And those are actually some of the more tense moments, because you're just kind of waiting on, like, especially as the movie goes on, it once the tension builds, it never stops building. And it gives you like little breathers where he's in the diner, but then that scene becomes its own little mini, you know, short film of suspense, you know, when he's trying to figure out which of the guys at the bar might be the truck driver, because you never really see the truck driver, which I think is a brilliant choice. Like, it really makes that truck seem like a monster. And Jaws was a monster movie to me, even though I do go in the ocean and I love the beach. I was never scared of the ocean. Like, even Jaws, and I know it did for a lot of people, but I always looked at Jaws as a monster film. I never looked at it as like, this might happen to me if I go in the ocean. Whereas Duel is, like you said, like, this might happen to me driving to work one day. I mean, it's just really scary. And I told you off air, and I think I tweeted it, that this was the only film that's actually given me a nightmare before. I had a dream that I was being chased by this damn truck, and I could not get away from it. And I finally, just like in the movie, I got away from it finally, and I thought I was in the clear. But then I ended up in my dream. I ended up in like, kind of like, I was getting like on the interstate, like I was waiting for my exit, and I'm like stuck in traffic and there's nowhere to go. Like I'm in like the middle lane and there's cars all around me. And I look in my rearview mirror and I see this damn truck just barreling toward me, just crushing, like just plowing through cars and never losing speed. And it's just coming right at me. And I woke up right as it's like about to just run over me. Like, and I couldn't go anywhere. There was nowhere to go, you know? And I had, what's funny is I had this dream probably like 10 years after I had even seen the movie last, you know, and it never left my mind. So I'm kind of watching it today. Like, I don't really remember all the ins and outs of the film. So watching it today, like I said, it had been like 20 years and watching it today it was just as good. Like, I'm like, damn, this movie's really tight. Like there's not a wasted moment in it. The act, I totally buy the performance and so much could have gone wrong. Like if you had picked somebody that couldn't carry the movie, but what's his name? Dennis Weaver. Is that his name?
Dennis Weaver. Yep.
Yeah. He carries the film perfect. Like I don't know anything else that he was in like off the top of my head, but he's really good in it. And, even the scene where, and it's one of those movies where it's almost like it treats it, there's a psychological element to it too, because it almost makes you feel like maybe he's like, we know as a filmmate, like I never really doubted that it was really happening, but like everybody else around him seems to not be aware of what he's going through and they think he's like acting crazy. And even with the school bus, you know, like it's a perfect, it's like this truck is somehow gaslighting him, you know, like he's like trying to get the kids to safety and the bus driver's like, you're acting crazy, man, or whatever, and tell him to leave the kids alone. He's like, get these kids out of here, this guy in the truck, he's gonna me, and nobody believes him. And then the truck actually comes and like helps the bus driver. So the whole time, like this truck driver that we never see, he's just tooling with this guy the whole time until the end when he's genuinely trying to murder him. I mean, the scene with the lady with the snakes or whatever, the little tourist trap gas station, obviously the truck's genuinely trying to kill him at that point too. But in the early part of the movie, you just think the truck's just messing with him. There's so many moments where it'll seemingly be like, okay, I'm done playing with you, man. Come on, you know, go ahead and pass or whatever. You'll see the hand of the truck driver kind of be like, you know, trying to wave him around. And then as soon as he gets around him, he either cuts him off and prevents him from passing, or he gets, you know, right back on his bumper. Like he's just never going to stop. And there's so many like shots that actually, it predates Mad Max and Terminator and all that. But when I watched the way James Cameron shoots like big rigs in the Terminator movies, the first two Terminators, and look at the way George Miller shoots like the road and the cars. I mean, there's only so many ways you can mount a camera on a car. I get that. But like some of the angles and stuff, I'm seeing like all that, like especially the first Mad Max, like there's so many shots in Duel that I feel like George Miller had to have seen Duel, man. He had to have. And even the Road Warrior with the, it's interesting that the big trucks are the bad guys in the Terminator movies, like, and Duel, but the big trucks in Mad Max movies are always like the beacons of hope, you know, like the big rigs. But I thought it was interesting just the way it was shot. There was just specific shots on the highway at the end where he just gets out and he's like walking toward the truck that reminded me of the original Mad Max, the way the camera, even the angle the camera was placed showing his showing him walking on the road and everything. And I'm just like, I mean, maybe it's a coincidence, but I just feel like this movie, I feel like Duel does have an influence. I feel like there's a visual influence. Like, it feels very fresh the way it's filmed. Like, there's not, I forgot to look up who did the cinematography, but it's very well shot. And I think that it was shot as a theatrical film because it shot for the widescreen. It's obviously not shot for a television. Yeah. And everybody would have been shooting for a boxy, you know, smaller picture if they were shooting it for television back then. So I feel like it's shot for the widescreen. I think in the UK it got a theatrical release, but for whatever reason here in the United States, it's crazy to me that it didn't get a, would it have made a difference, you know, for its prestige and everything if it had a theatrical release in the US? Maybe that's why it was kind of ignored. Like, I don't know. Very strange. Cause it's great. Like even the ending, like I thought as a Texas Chainsaw Massacre fan, you had to appreciate that. Yeah. So, right? Like, didn't it feel like maybe he was drawing from Toby Hooper's Chainsaw Massacre? Because I feel like, well, no, this came out before that.
This before. Maybe Hooper drew from that. Yeah.
Because you see how completely deranged, even after the truck goes off the cliff, like he's not convinced that that fucker's dead until the wheel stops spinning on the truck. Like he sits there like kind of celebrating, but then he's like not wholly convinced. It's almost like a slasher movie. Like, is the truck coming back? And this is before that was even a trope. So he's just like, he's staring at that damn thing. Like, I genuinely couldn't remember, because it's a tanker truck, so I'm expecting like it just to erupt into a fireball or something.
That's what I thought when I rewatched it. I was like, oh, wasn't it supposed to blow up? And it, but it doesn't.
Well, it's that shot from T2, like when the truck runs under the underpass and you see the gas leaking in the, and it goes and it just explodes, you know. And that's kind of trained into my brain. And it's also a movie, so when a car crashes, you expect an explosion. But it's because it's a tanker truck, so. I really couldn't remember if it explodes, so I thought he was gonna watch it and then it would explode and that'd be the end. But it was kind of cool, because I feel like maybe Spielberg was playing with our, he kept showing the back of the truck and it says flammable and all that, so you're expecting a fireball. And I thought it kind of messes with your expectations, because at the end the only thing we see leaking out of that truck is almost very dry. It's very strange, like when it crashes, the only thing you act, the one moment of gore in the film is just the you see blood dripping on the steering wheel, you know, and you're assuming, and like you have to assume that the driver is dead at that point, but he doesn't show anything, so it's like it's almost like the truck itself is bleeding and dying, you know? Like, once again, he does this in a way that makes it feel almost supernatural, even though he's
that's right, because you don't really even, you see the blood, but it's not like you see, you know, an arm hanging or a leg dangling or anything like that. You do just see just the blood, I think, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, just the blood. And it's a very dark, it's not like your typical movie blood from the 70s. Like in 1971, it almost, most of the time when you see blood, you'd see like it looked like red paint or something. This is like, actually, like it almost kind of looks like oil. And I was like, is that supposed to be oil or is that supposed to be blood? I think it's supposed to be blood. But it's really dark. You know, and it's interesting watching it, because it looked really good on this Voodoo copy that we watched. It was in HD. And I know the version I saw back in the day was on a standard, you know, 480 television, you know, 19-inch television or something on a VHS tape. So, I mean, it looked really good watching it today. So, I mean, anyway, it's very interesting. Like, he's really, the whole movie, like Spielberg is, and whoever else worked on it, they just did a really good job, because the whole movie, it just messes with your head the whole time. And at the end, like, the way the fan was kind of spinning and then the way the wheel kind of stopped, most of the time that would have been the moment, like, when the motion stopped, that it would have been, like, that pause and then boom, it would have exploded, and they never do it. And then instead it cuts to Sally. I mean, he's kind of like Sally at the end of Texas Chainsaw, where he's just exhausted and frantic. And then the sunset shot, that's actually what I was getting at earlier, where I was like, it kind of reminded me of Texas Chainsaw, because when I think of the final girl, in this case, the final guy, in a slasher movie, you know, they're genuinely like, he's frantic and exhausted and happy that he's alive. And then the shot of the sunset so gorgeous, but that's the Texas Chainsaw shot for me. Like, it's burned into my head. Like, it's such a beautiful final shot, but Spielberg did it first, so.
I was gonna say, and you know, that sort of that stop and go with the way the truck antagonizes him, I would like to believe that that's would be attributed to Richard Matheson, who wrote the script, adapting his own short story. And Richard Matheson, as you know, everybody, you know, very, very prolific in fantasy, horror, sci-fi, wrote, you know, many episodes of The Twilight Zone. The one I was thinking most of is Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, the way you're describing how, like, the sort of on and off of the truck antagonizing him, much like how the, you know, the gremlin, yeah. nobody
like it's sees like it's trying to make people not believe him just to fuck with him or whatever.
Yeah, like with that episode, William Shatner's the only one that sees the gremlin all the time, or that, or when the Simpsons did it, you know,
yeah.
And yeah. No one believed Bart.
Yeah, man, it's so good though. It really that's funny that you. I'm glad you said that too, because like I would give Spielberg credit for just how good him and the cinematographer for how good the movie looks, the way he places the camera. But the script is phenomenal, and it really would have worked. I could totally see this being chopped down and being a really solid Twilight Zone episode if they had had the, you know, if they had had the budget to shoot on location like that and actually utilize the highway like that. Like I could see that working as a really tense hour of television. And so I totally can buy that. Like they could add, really what adds the 30 minutes would be like the diner scene, and you could cut that if you had to for a television show, you know. Although I love that, I mean, I'm not saying cut it because it was great. Like I love that scene too. Like even the moment where he confronts that one guy that he thinks is the driver, it's not funny. Like it's actually kind of scary because
I sort of cringed during that scene.
Yeah, it's uncomfortable.
It's not because of like, you know, it's badly written, but like, you know, you get his perspective. Someone's been messing with him, and he's trying to put a stop to it. And then, but then you got the, you know, this driver, you know, he's like, yo, like, you know, what's your problem?
And he's actually taking it pretty well at first. He's just like, dude, what are you talking about? Like, he's reacting the way, like, I probably would in that situation. I probably wouldn't go, like, nuts. Like, obviously, the dude's going through something. But when he slaps the sandwich out of his hand, you still kind of understand why he's like, dude, you're not going to slap my sandwich out of my hand. And he's eating like he's never eaten before, like he's starving or something. But yeah, like, that's crazy, man. Like, and then the of course, the big shot, the way it's shot and everything. And when he goes out and you see that he's not him, he gets in a different truck. You're like, oh, okay. And he profiles the other guy, and the other guy gets in a different truck. So it's like, okay, do we see the driver? Is he one of those guys at the bar? Or did he never leave the truck? I feel like he never left the truck.
No, that's exactly what I'm thinking. I'm thinking it's to show, yeah, that he never came in the diner.
But they have so many. It's like the red herrings, like in a good slasher movie. Like it could be anybody. It could be anybody. Everybody's a suspect. But yeah, it's solid, man. I love this movie. Like I'm gonna definitely watch this one over and over. Now I'm like more convinced than ever that I need to get this new 4K that's coming out of it, so I can put it on my Spielberg shelf.
Oh, it is coming to a 4K. Oh,
yeah, I think so. Yeah,
because
I watching it today, I feel like, you know, yeah, it's gonna look good. So I don't even have it on Blu-ray. If I had it on Blu-ray, I'd probably be fine with that. But all I have is the digital copy. So.
You were asking about the cinematography, and the cinematographer was Jack Marta, who did, God knows, I'm just looking at this filmography here. He did a crap ton of movies, and I've never heard of, just scrolling through this, I've never heard of any of them. They are definitely all B pictures.
He killed it on this movie, though.
Yeah, but according to Spielberg, he said that he was a kind, gentle soul who, you know, had never worked that fast. Apparently, he must have had to work fast for Spielberg. But I would be surprised, because with all these movies he did, he definitely did some quick turnaround with some of these. But yeah, I'd never heard of any of these movies. But yeah, that cinematography is
well. I wonder. The speed of it, like they didn't really do anything totally crazy stunt wise. Like they weren't, like I said that some of the shots even reminded me of the way Miller shots parts of Mad Max, but they weren't doing anything crazy like they were doing in Mad Max. Like all the Mad Max movies had like really insane shit that like a low budget film typically would not have, because it would be super dangerous. The stuff that Miller got people to do on motorcycles and with cars is, in all of those movies is freaking nuts. But you don't see any of that really so much with I mean, you, other than like the truck chasing him when he's on foot and stuff, that seems, stuff seems pretty hairy. It's just really the way it's shot. It makes it seem really intense and scary. But like, I feel like there weren't that many movies where there was this much location shooting in the, in like the early 70s with cars just driving down the road and as much highway as they had to use. Like, I doubt that they went like, I doubt they had to go like super far out of California, you know what I'm saying, to get these shots, but they really utilize like natural scenery a lot. So it feels like you're on the road for a long way. Like, I don't know how many miles they shot like outside of the city, but they really made it feel like he's gone a long, long way away from home. And they never use the same location. I mean, even the ending where it ends up on the cliff, like, he, Spielberg really uses the real life location well. So whoever did the location scouting did a fantastic job as well, like picking the actual, you know, spots to shoot. And I think that if you're shooting something in set in the 70s, you're shooting out in the middle, and I've been out in the middle of nowhere out west, and I don't know if you've been out there, but like, it's, there are times where it's like desolate. Might actually be able to get away with setting up a camera and getting some shots without even seeing another car while you're out there.
Yeah, I've always wondered that, like, you know, when you watch a movie and, like you said, it seems like it's on those western highways, and it just seems like nobody, you know, a car might go by and nobody else is going to be come down that road for like another,
it's scary,
4 hours.
Yeah, it's actually kind of frightening. Like, but every now and then you will pass like a big ass truck or just a random car or whatever. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of terrifying because there's just nothing around. And some of those places, I haven't been out there since the age of cell phones, but I imagine your cell phone signal probably isn't very good when you get out that far either. So, but yeah, so here we are. Like, here's a horror film that from the 70s that cell phones would not have really fixed anything. You know what I mean? Like, what's he going to do? Maybe he could have gotten in touch with the cops a little sooner, but, you know, that's kind of iffy with a cell phone anyway when you're out on the highway. So,
and that's what I was surprised. I was surprised that, like, at some point, because, you know, in most slasher movies, someone always runs across, you know, the people being terrorized usually always run across the cops at some point.
Even though the cops are usually really bad at doing anything, but yeah.
Yeah, and then the cop usually ends up getting killed at some point, with the exception of Dewey in the Scream series. But yeah.
He's still not a great cop. He's more like, he's a good person that just happens to be a really shitty cop.
But I was surprised that, I was like, oh, Spielberg didn't even have him run across the cops, and you know, the cops just don't believe him. Because, like, you know, a movie like this, if it was shot today, there would have been a scene where he's like, hey, this truck is coming to get me. Let's just say he ran across a cop in the middle of the road. He's like, hey, there's this truck and he's chasing me and blah, blah, blah. And the cop would have been like, all right, well, all right, give me your name. What does the truck look like? He is going to be like, it's, and then boom, that's what you'd heard.
You know what he did? Yeah. You know what he did do, though? That was really brilliant. I love that shot because I actually forgot about this, where he sees the pest control guy and it looks exactly like a cop car, and he like gets excited. Like, you can see it. Like, he feels like, oh shit, there's a cop. And he like pulls over really quick, like he's going to talk to the cop, and then he gets closer and it's the pest control car. Did you get, you caught that, right? Like, it's.
Yeah.
And then he like takes off, and then the truck almost actually kills the poor pest control guy. The guy has to jump up on the hood of his car, but the car looks like a black and white, like, you know, it looks like a squad car or whatever. And I thought that was kind of clever, because I in my head, just seeing it from a distance when it first shows it, I was like, oh, there's a cop. Okay, so what's gonna happen here? I bet the cop's gonna die. And then he gets closer to the pest control guy. I was like, shit, I forgot about that. But yeah, it actually got me. So it's like Spielberg was aware of things. He was aware of things, but I feel like that might have been a budget issue. Is like, okay, getting real cop cars and stuff obviously is going to take. Whereas that was what I was kind of getting at. So they're shooting out in the middle of nowhere, and I'm wondering, when he talks about the cinematographer shooting fast, I wonder how much they had permits and stuff. You know what I mean? Like, what was required in that at that time in the 70s, as far as permits to shoot on the road. And were they kind of doing this guerrilla style? Were they using permits for in the city and then not using them when they were out in the desert? Like, if they were shooting really quick and doing quick setups, it makes me think that they might have been trying to save some money and time by not having to get permits.
Why do I think Spielberg? Because there's on the Blu-ray, there's like a little mini documentary. And why do I think Spielberg actually did say that almost exactly word for word what you were just saying? Now I got to go back and listen to it again.
I mean, it wouldn't surprise me, and that makes a little more sense when you're talking about like the cinematographer not used to that pace. Like, yeah, they would have been doing like really quick setups. Because if you ever watch the little documentary, because there's really not a lot of behind the scenes stuff on the Terminator, but where they talk about getting that final shot of Sarah in the Jeep, they had to lie because they were out in the middle of nowhere outside of LA shooting that scene, and a cop actually pulled up on them and asked for a shooting permit, and they lied and said they were shooting, like, whoever was running the camera was like, oh, it's my son's student film. And they're like, convinced the cop that they were just some student filmmakers. And they were like, well, he was like, well, you got to hurry up and get it then. So they hurried up and got the shot and got out of there. But they didn't have the time and the budget to waste to get a permit. So Ghostbusters 1 does that. Like, all those scenes of them running through the streets of New York and during the montage. And you see people like chasing after them in a couple shots. Those are people that are actually like genuinely chasing them, because they want some, that's why they're running in some of those shots. They're not supposed to be shooting on the street in front of those businesses and stuff. So.
Good old fashioned guerrilla filmmaking.
So, I mean, I think that, you know, if you're doing something like that, obviously now the cameras are smaller. You can jump in there. You can run through we've ran through a shopping mall before shooting, me and John have. So, I mean, it is possible nowadays, but back then, with those big cameras, I mean, think about how much of an effort that was to set up and get right, and, you know, have to get, you know, break it down and get another shot or whatever. Like, but it really pays off in this movie. Like, I can't recommend it enough to anyone out there listening. This movie actually, I'm very impressed. It held up for me. It's now, like, I had to move it up in my Spielberg rankings. Like, I'm having to, it kind of made me think, what's going to fall out of the top five now? Because I always had it kind of high up, but I think it was in like number 7 or 8. I think it's better. Like, I think I like it more than some of the other. I think I like it more than Jurassic Park. That's.
No, I'm
sorry. I know you're a Michael Crichton guy.
Oh, no. That's fine. Because Jaws is number one, and Duel is number two.
Okay.
For me, Jurassic Park is number no. Yeah, Jurassic Park would be number three. Raiders of the Lost Ark is number four. I'd have to think about what it would be. Probably Saving Private Ryan would probably be my number five. But
see, I think I like some of his dramatic stuff more than some people too, and I think Spielberg does drama really well when it's darker. When it's like, when he leans into the material and he's willing to not try to sanitize it, you know what I mean? So something like Munich or Saving Private Ryan, even, which I feel like gets unfairly maligned sometimes because I think it's a great movie, but some people just hate that movie for whatever reason, because it's like this weird rivalry between Saving Private Ryan and The Thin Red Line, which came out the same year, but they're both great movies with different goals.
Yeah. And I do like The Thin Red Line, but yeah, like you said, they were both two different. Spielberg and Terrence Malick are just, they're two different types of filmmakers.
Yeah, and I don't think they had the same goal at all with those movies. And yeah. I don't think that Saving Private Ryan is a. I feel like after 9/11, there was this idea that Saving Private Ryan was somehow a pro-war film or something, and I never got that from it at all. Like, I saw it as I was probably like 14 or 15 or whatever when I saw Saving Private Ryan, and I did not think that it made me want to go to war whatsoever.
Nope.
It's pretty gut-wrenching. Like, I had never seen anything quite like that before on screen. And Schindler's List, The Color Purple, you know, when he leans into these subjects that are more sanitized by most media, I feel, and you could criticize him, I'm sure, for certain points of any of these movies, any of his more popcorn fare. But I think when he leans into that, he's one of the better dramatic filmmakers out there. Even movies like, even his popcorn films have really solid, you know, emotional beats. Like even the kids stuff like E.T., it has the emotional, you know, core to it. So that's one thing he does well. Whereas movie like Duel, to me as a horror film fan, it just hits that sweet spot. And I think Jaws has more of a heart. Jaws has more emotion. It has deeper characters. Duel, you don't really get to know your protagonist or your antagonist very well, but somehow that's the movie's just lean and mean, and that's kind of the strength of it, is that it's just a different experience. It's a slasher film without a body count. Like, nobody dies except for the bad guy.
Yeah, the drive. Yeah, except for the drive. Yeah, that's a great point about the characters, because yeah, like when you watch Jaws, you know, you're there for Brody, Hooper, and Quint. You know, you attach to those three, and they're three different types of personalities. You don't, like you said, you don't know anything about David Mann in Duel. All you know
he's on the outs with his wife over some incident at a party with some friends or something.
You just watch Duel saying, I don't want to be where he is right now.
Right. And it's kind of relatable because you don't, like you just said, for that reason, like you like we said at the beginning of the show, you could totally be in this damn situation and it's scary as hell. But it, to me, it's just the experience of the film. Like, the entire hour and 30 minutes is just so enjoyable and so tense, and it's the scariest movie where nobody dies. Like, it's the scariest movie I could think of where nobody dies. And that's kind of an incredible feat. Like, I can't think of another horror film that does that.
I mean, unless any
maybe those... Poltergeist or something like that, which is the Spielberg effect as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not the person that thinks Tobe Hooper didn't have anything to do with it. I'm just saying, like, it's kind of funny that, to me, Spielberg's not a horror filmmaker, but he's been part of some of the best, like, horror films out there. Like, even some of his stuff, like Jurassic Park, is not a horror film, but it's horror adjacent. Like, as a kid watching it, it had the same thrills as something like Jaws did, you know. I get the same, like, I still am, the scene with the T-Rex and the Jeep and the tree and all that stuff, like that's, and the raptors, holy shit, the raptors in the kitchen. Yep. Like, that stuff's still scary. Like, it's still really well done.
Or even if you think of, or with the Indiana Jones movies, you know, they're these pulpy throwback adventure films, and you know, a lot of their spirit is also because of George Lucas. But you know at the, you know, just think, you know, those have their moments that, like, yeah, Spielberg knows how to put up some horror. You know, at the end we have face melting Nazis, and, you know, all the stuff.
Well, there's the violence, and especially in Raiders, is pretty hardcore for a kid, for a kind of, not a kids movie, but a family movie. Like, you can watch it, like I have watched it with my older kids, and it's probably a little more violent than what you typically would get. Like, you don't probably, if you think of, like, what's a good example of something like Indiana Jones now, would be like the Marvel films.
Yeah.
And you don't typically get really, you don't see, like, I would say, like, the first Captain America feels a little more in line. Maybe it's just because the World War II setting, but it feels a little more in line with, like, Indiana Jones, with the violence even. But, like, Indiana Jones, the gunfight in the bar, were, like, with the bullets actually have impact, and there's blood, and you know, it feels a little more adult than what you would get now. I think if you... when you see whatever they do for Indiana Jones 4 or 5, I'm sorry, 5, it won't have the same impact as Raiders, because they just don't make stuff like that. You know, nowadays I feel like Raiders hits kind of hard. Like, it feels like it's maybe a harder rating than it would get a harder rating now. They would have to trim back some of the blood and stuff. But, like, the scene where the very beginning of the movie where they go in the cave and the guy, you know, takes his whip or whatever, and then, you know, he thinks he's gonna get out with the idol, and then when Indy, you know, makes it through at the last second, the guy's like impaled on the wall, like with the spear yep. coming through his face. Like, that stuff's scary when you're a kid. Like, it gets you when you're a little kid. So yeah, he liked doing that kind of stuff.
Even when you watch, like, or his War of the Worlds. Even though
movie's terrifying.
You know, yeah, like when the Martians that come, you know, first arrive and they're Ray, Tom Cruise is running through the street and that beam is just disintegrating people and ash is just falling all over. That's terrifying.
Yeah. That's that part of his career where his stuff got kind of dark. Like, I feel like World of Worlds is a little darker than what I expected it to be from Spielberg. Like, it doesn't feel like, this feels like an older, maybe a little more cynical Spielberg.
he did have that and Munich back to back in 2005.
Munich was one of the only movies I've ever watched with my head in my hands the whole time. Like, yeah. I mean, shit. Of that movie, like I love that movie, but I had a hard time with it because it felt like there was so much weight to it, and it's hard to explain. Like, you don't usually watch movies, they feel like they're pressing down on your chest while you're watching them, and that movie felt like that to me. But yeah, that good stuff, man. Like, I think Spielberg does that. I think he sets out, kind of like we were talking about with Carpenter, I do think that he sets out and says, I want this movie to make you feel this way. And when he accomplishes that, it's amazing. He might have had a few movies that didn't accomplish it, but like, he probably accomplished it more than most. But I don't think that every one of his movies is the same, even during the Amblin years, like the classic Amblin years. I don't think that Close Encounters feels exactly like E.T., even though there's a shared, you know. Like, you could tell they're related, but they're not the same. They have different goals, and that's one of the things I think Duel sets out to do. If you're looking at how you and I typically look at movies, how do they affect us? What do we feel when we watch them? We're talking on Photo Flow of more of an emotional response to them than strictly like film criticism, obviously. Duel, what it sets out to make you feel, it does that very well.
It absolutely does. Like, I you know, a couple weeks ago when we were not recording, and I let you know that we were supposed to record, but I let you know that I wasn't because our car had broke down, and I was on my way out and the car broke down, and I wasn't fully in the street, but I was just enough in the street that cars could squeeze by, but enough that if it was a slightly larger car, it couldn't squeeze by. And then I was blocking this lady's driveway because that was just as far as I could get the car. And I remember I was still in it, waiting for a tow truck to arrive, and someone had rolled up, came up behind me. They had honked their horn. I had the flashers on and everything, but I guess they thought I might have just been just sitting there. And so I just remember I just kind of just got out the car to kind of like wave and like try to say I'm stuck. But I remember when I got out the car, I remember seeing the guy sort of lean back and, you know, just, you know, because it's like, you know, that's what happens. You know, if you honk your horn and then someone just gets out their car, that would put you on edge a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, it's like a body language thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, you know, I got, you know, and, you know, the other day I went to pick up some food for us, and I was backing out of, the parking space, and this car was about to back into me. I had to lean on the horn for them to stop. But then they turned to me and was like giving me a look. So once again, it's like, that's just how delicate a balance it is when people are in their cars and just anything can happen.
It's a territory thing, I think. Like, instinctively, some people are more aware of it. I try to be aware of it. I'm in the car. Well, I used to be in the car a lot on the road, like commuting and stuff. But some people are super generous with their territory and other people aren't. And I think that when they're, to them, they're in the car, that section of the road that they're on at any given time is their territory. And yep, anytime someone dares infringe upon that territory, they feel like they have to protect it or something. Like, I don't know, man. If people get really, it is like, I could totally buy a future like the Mad Max future, because I feel like that's exactly how people act now, just with laws keeping them from going completely feral, you know? But yeah, people get really weird behind the wheel sometimes. And I think a lot of it's to do with property. Like, your car is your property, you know? Like, I don't think, I mean, I'm sure people act crazy on public transit too, but I'm just saying, like, I don't think when you're on a bus, you necessarily feel comfortable to be, like, I don't anyway. I'm just keep to myself kind of a person. If I'm on like a bus or like anytime I've ever been on a subway or anything like that, like, it's just a different situation. But in your car, it's your space, your music, your settings, and people just get really weird about stuff. But yeah, it taps into something for me, man. Like, I'm trying to think of what's another movie that just has that. I mean, Terminator is like a fun version of Duel, where, I mean, not that Duel's not fun, but I'm saying, like, I'm not necessarily scared watching it. It's like a fun science fiction movie. But another movie that made me feel dread, like Duel, the closest I could think of before we started recording, I was thinking, what's another movie that kind of captured that, like, you just can't get away from this thing? And the only movie popped in my head is another horror film that I consider a horror film, even though it's not really a horror film, by a group of filmmakers that really are known more for comedic stuff, but like No Country for Old Men. No Country for Old Men felt kind of like Duel to me, in the way that, like, you just can't get away from this dude, and kind of like the truck, and he almost feels supernatural. He's just like the devil himself, you know. And I remember seeing that in the theater, and it just feeling relentless. Like, granted, like, he kind of brings it upon himself. Like, I don't really feel like Dennis Weaver's character, whatever his first name was, I don't feel like he deserves what happens. Like, I don't think he did anything to that truck driver to really deserve the level of whatever. Whereas, like, Josh Brolin's character in No Country, he gets involved in shit by getting that money, you know. Even though he was trying to do the right thing by bringing the water to that guy, like, he ultimately could have left that blood money alone and he would have been fine. He takes somebody's money and he gets caught up in something that he was not prepared to be caught up in. And so, but you still feel sorry for him because he stole the devil's money in that movie. You know, and it's just like, man, you really don't know what you just stepped in. And it's just relentless. And I just remember being like, it's kind of a scary, to me, that's a scary movie. That's a scarier movie than any slasher movie, because that's also seemingly something that, you know, could potentially happen. So if I ever see a bag of money and a bunch of dead bodies around it, I ain't touching that shit. I don't care how much money it is on. Somebody's gonna miss that money. There's enough people that are dead over that money. I'm leaving it alone, you know. But yeah, like, I just, that was the only movie I could think of where I felt like he's relentless, and then seeing that's even worse, because at the end of the movie he's still out there. You know, like, at least at the end of Duel you get the satisfaction that the truck is dead. Like, but yeah, totally cool, man. Like, I enjoyed it. I'm glad we got to see it again. And the next picks are yours, so you just let me know what we're watching and we'll do this again next week.
Time to look through. I had an idea. I know we sort of had a development point.
And you can switch them around too, if you think there'd be something else that would pair up well, or doesn't even have to pair. It could just be like on the complete opposite tone or whatever. It's fine.
I had like three or four ideas in my head at the moment, but I have to whittle it down so I can let you know what might be.
Yeah, just shoot me a message. It doesn't have to be announced today.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was cool, man. I had fun with it.
Yeah, like I said, every time I watch it, I just say, when we talk about Spielberg's best, Duel needs to be in it. And I just think that, you know, and it doesn't seem like it's a difficult movie to find to watch. I just don't think that maybe too many people just haven't seen it.
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, it's just like, I never heard of it, you know, like, until I saw that interview. And that was because I was just a big Jaws fan and got the DVD and wanted to see all the behind the scenes stuff, because the VHS that I had for years didn't have anything. So I was just digging through it, and it just was, like, he kind of mentions it almost like a footnote, you know, and I'm like, I kind of want to see that. So yeah. it worked out because we had a satellite, you know, subscription that had all these movie channels, and it just so happened that that was one of the movies they were playing. So I just got, you know, lucky because I was looking for it. If I hadn't came across that, I probably would still have never seen it because it's not something you, I mean, other than Film Nerds Online, I mean, how often have I come, I can't think of any time it's ever played on like broadcast television or, I mean, I think I showed it to my parents for the first time. I don't even think they had ever seen it until I had it on tape or whatever. So, and they really liked it too. It's funny because my dad's a truck driver and he had just started driving. When he first got his CDL license, he became like, he got his first job just so he could get experience. The first year, he decided to take a job driving. He delivered furniture from Hickory, North Carolina to California. So he would drive out to Los Angeles, deliver furniture. They'd load the truck back up with fresh fruit and drive it back to the East Coast. And so he did that for like a year just because at that time, I don't know if it's still the case, but at that time, if you had cross-country experience, it's easier to get a local job driving a truck. But like nobody local wanted to hire an inexperienced, you know, big rig driver, obviously. So after he had experience driving cross country, they were like, he was able to immediately, right, almost as soon as that first year was up, he was able to get a job local. And so I think he saw this movie. He saw Duel for the first time right as he was getting ready to drop a big rig. And he had gone through school for it. And then he had never driven one until he went. Like, this was after the factory closed that he worked in for years and years. And he's like, I got to find something else to do. Well, I can drive a truck. Let me go to school and learn how to drive an 18-wheeler. And that's what he did. So, but yeah, he was never like the typical truck driver. He was never cut out for the living on the road type truck driving. Yeah. He just did that while, you know, for experience. So, but Duel was one that I think that at that time, I haven't asked him about it in years, but he seemed to really enjoy it. It was scary. And he had, you know, it's probably a little bit different for you if you've maybe driven one of those trucks. I think I've stepped up in the cab of one time. I'm like, I will never, ever drive one of these things. Like, that is too much vehicle for me and too much responsibility. So,
oh yeah, I have a friend who got his license and does it, and yeah, I always think the same thing. I'm just like, my legs get tired after like an hour of driving.
I'm not a fan of that much driving.
Yeah.
Even now, my dad, he gets home every night, but he thinks it's like nothing to him to drive from like Charlotte or in this area to Wilmington to the coast. And that's like a 4-hour drive, dude. And he'll do that. Like, if he gets a job on the coast, a lot of times it's like he might do two runs that day. But driving 8 hours in one day, like, I can sit in an office for 12 hours, but I cannot sit in a vehicle for, I mean, no. I could do it on a trip, don't get me wrong, but I can't do that like every day. I would go crazy. Like, it would drive me nuts. I'd be so tired all the time. Like, one just yesterday, driving to the meeting and driving around with Heather, like, for a few hours, like, running errands, and we got back home and I'm just like, I'm exhausted. You know, maybe spent like 2.5 hours in the car and I was done. But yeah, man, it was it's cool. Speaking of the James, I was talking about Terminator. Well, we know James Cameron got his start working for Corman in the film industry, but before then he was a truck driver. So all the truck stuff in Terminator comes from, like, the reason why he wrote that thing in of Arnold still in the big rig in the end of Terminator 1 was actually because he was a truck driver. He thought that scenario would be scary, you know, to be chased down by an 18-wheeler. But I still can't help but think, hey, Spielberg did it first, man. Like, and the way he makes the camera angles make that truck look scary to me. Like, it's just not the, I mean, I don't really like being beside him in traffic anyway, but I think about it every time I see one of those bastards coming up really fast in my rearview mirror. I'm thinking of Duel. Anyway, man. All right. Well, I had fun, and let me know what you want to do next week.
I was going through. Like I said, I had about a couple ideas that I was thinking, but I got to whittle them down before I have it come to a conclusion.
Cool deal. Well, you have a good night, man, and good day tomorrow. And I will go feed these kids. All right, man. Take it easy.
Yep.
Podcast Ask Us Many Questions. Who will listen and who will return next week? Who will take the time to rate and review? Check for a new episode of Photo Flow every week. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Photo Flow Terror and Instagram on Photo Flow _Terror. Thank you for listening to Photo Flow. We'll find the terror in the smiles.